I love standing here on Tuesday mornings just for a minute or two and watching and listening. It's called community and friendships and love and relationships, and I think that's what we're supposed to be in. So as you can tell, my voice is a little bit shot, not quite sure if it's a cough or a cold or just, I don't know. But if I start sounding like this, you'll just have to bear with me because that's what my voice is doing today, so I'll do my best. Let's pray and we'll jump in. Lord God, you are the sovereign creator of the world, and yet you come to us and seek us out and move towards us, and you work with us and relate to us and call us by name and are kind to us and challenge us and judge us and love us and gather us together in a community, because that's how you are. You draw people into relationships with each other, with your creation, and with yourself. Sometimes when we try to do those things, though, we hurt one another. And so you give us the gift of the law, the gift of ordinances and covenant practices and legislative details to help us work out the kinks of living together in society. And today we're going to look at some ancient versions of that you gave to those original Israelites who had just come out of slavery. Help us to understand them, but more importantly, help us to understand something about your mind and your heart from studying these truths. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, I'm going to read just a little bit of Exodus 21. I think you were challenged to read Exodus 21, 22, and 23. Hopefully you made it through. It's not easy reading because you're reading case law. How many of you study law books at night? That's what you're reading here. And so one of the challenges of reading the Bible, sometimes people come to me and say, Pastor Glenn, the Bible's hard to understand. You're right. It's hard for me to understand, and I've got 5 years of school to help me understand it, because the Bible itself carries probably 54 or 55 different genres of literature. So you have poetry, you have love songs, you have personal letters, you have apocalyptic texts, you have prophetic texts, you have historical texts, you have military chronological orders, you have birth documents, you have all kinds of stuff. And now we're in Exodus chapter 21, and the next two or three chapters are really all about legislative detail. This is like picking up the Illinois Constitution or the Naperville Code and trying to read it and make sense of it. And if you picked up the Naperville Code and tried to read it and make sense of it, even though it's modern and written for us, you would still say there's a lot of therefores and theretos and thereuntos. It's hard to read. So that's why this is hard. It's hard for me. It's hard for you. So just give yourself a little bit of grace and, oh, okay, I'm not weird for thinking this is strange stuff. Second thing is, you read some of it and the stuff you do understand, you go, what? What? So we are reading case law, civil law, religious law, not from modern Naperville. This is from 3,500 years ago in ancient Canaan, in the Middle East. I've said many times, and I need to keep saying, that is orders of magnitude times 1,000 different than anything about our culture. When it talks about children or property or oxen or houses or marriage or any of those things, the words look the same. But what they mean by that is radically different. So we've got to give the text the grace to speak to its own age. So that's the second challenge of reading this. The third challenge is, well then, so what? Is it for me? Yes, but there's a discernment that has to happen. This is not God saying, and here's the laws about how you should regulate virginity. But somewhere in there, there's a principle that translates into a modern culture. And that's where the challenge comes in. And so we're going to try to wrestle with this. This is not easy stuff to teach, because we could spend weeks just going through it verse by verse. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to trust you to read it and have some conversations in your group. But I'm just going to read a little bit of Exodus 21 so you get a flavor. Remember, we just read the Ten Commandments themselves, and a lot of people think, gosh, the Ten Commandments, that's it. Yep, except that it continues, because the Ten Commandments need refinement. They need application. They need the what if and the what if and the what if. Have you ever seen one of those documents that says, if this, then that, if that, then this, and if that, then this, and if this, then that? And it guides you through these arrows. That's what this is. This is the if, then this. So here we go. Now these are the rules that you shall set before them. Exodus chapter 21, verse 1. When you buy a Hebrew slave, how many of you have recently bought a slave? So immediately, we have to say we're in a different world, using language of slavery and all of that. We'll talk about that in a minute, but I just want you to see right off the bat. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh, he shall go out free for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out for free, then his master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl. Somebody said, ew, that's weird. I said, have you ever seen anybody get an earring pierced? That's what it is. Well, maybe a smaller awl. I don't know. I've never had my ears pierced. Some of you have, so I don't know. Hopefully you can relate. And he shall be a slave forever. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, okay, now it's getting really strange. People say to me all the time, be careful, because the word slavery in the Old Testament doesn't always mean the same thing. We translate it into what we think we mean by slavery in this country 150, 200 years ago. That's true. There are different meanings to the word slave, and we have to take that into consideration. But as soon as you jump down to verse 7 and it says, when a man sells his daughter, I don't care what meaning you put on the word, we're in a different world. Because I'm not going to sell my daughter. I have two of them. I'm not going to sell my daughter. She shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. It's a strange world. So let me just back up and give a little illustration to this. I really, even in 5 years in seminary and studying this and learning Hebrew and all of the culture, you still don't get this until you see it come alive. Some of you were here yesterday or Sunday, and you got to hear my daughter talk about her experience in Papua New Guinea, which is not even a third world country. It's more like fourth or fifth or whatever, something like that. Cannibalism still alive. 89% of the people live a subsistence agrarian lifestyle in grass huts. It is a very, very different culture. And when I first went there, my daughter, I had done her wedding here. And it was a traditional American wedding in a church not far from here, in a white dress, and they were in tuxes and all that stuff. Although they did walk out barefoot, as a sort of connection to his culture, because in his culture they're barefoot. To which my mother-in-law said, how can you be barefoot in your own wedding? I said, well, there's nothing in the Bible that says you can't be barefoot at your wedding, so it's okay. So then we went over to New Guinea, and my daughter was pregnant. She gave birth to her first son there. But while they were there, her in-laws wanted to have a traditional wedding in New Guinea. And I said, okay, and when are we going to have it? And they said, we're going to have it on Tuesday. And I said, oh, okay, that's an interesting day. Well, how will you send out invitations? They said, what's an invitation? I said, well, how will people get here? Oh, well, they'll hear. Sure enough, that Tuesday, about 1,200 people came walking down the mountains with goats and chickens and handmade bags called billums and fruit and vegetables, because you bring gifts. And some of them came with their shields and their spears. And I said, I am not in Kansas anymore. And we got to the middle of the ceremony. Well, this is after they woke me up at 6 o'clock in the morning and I had to go watch the sacrifice of the cow and the pig and reach in and take the heart. And oh, yeah, I won't go further. It was just weird. Let's just say that. I'd never done that at any other wedding that I'd done before. So we got into the middle of this ceremony, and there's a translator, and we're going back and forth, and they call me out into the middle, and they say a bunch of stuff. Some of you have heard me tell this story, but it relates directly to this. And the translator said, your son-in-law's father wants to give you the bride price. And I said, oh, no, that's, no. I'm from the United States. We don't do that. And the translator looked at me, and he said, do you see all these people here? You've got about 30 seconds to accept this, or you're going to offend them, and there are four tribes here, and they will be at war. And he was not kidding. And I said, okay, I'll take the bride price. And they said, well, normally it would be, and I don't know, a number of cows, chickens, pigs. They said, but since you're from the United States and you can't take all that back on the plane with you, we took the liberty, we hope it's okay, of selling all that for you. And here's the money. And they gave me an envelope with the equivalent of $2,500 American cash. And I looked at it and I said, I've got another daughter at home. I never understood all this stuff in the Old Testament until I stood in the middle of it, and it came alive. And they said, Glenn, you have to understand, a woman has great value in our culture. This is not about devaluing her. She has the only capability of bringing children into the world. That's of economic value. She is to be valued because you're taking her from her family, and that means her family's economic ability has diminished. And I thought, okay. And then they said, plus that, she is the only one who can bring sons into the world. And you need to have sons to take over the property at some point in time. And you need to have sons, if you have a lot of property, to carry the spears and the shields to fight off the other tribe's sons who are trying to take your land. So believe me, this is a big deal. And every one of my grandchildren that has been born to them, I've gotten a little bit more of a bride price because the children are economic produce from, it's a crazy world, but until I stood in the middle of it, I did not understand. Now, I'm not suggesting we bring those laws to Naperville. I am suggesting that when you see it in action, you realize there's an entirely different intent than we think when we read this stuff. So when I read this, what you are reading is case law that God gave to the children of Israel saying, you are about ready to move into Canaan. And it is a bizarre, strange, brutal, ugly, weird world where they worship all kinds of gods, and those gods require of them fertility rights. The gods control a woman and her reproductive rights. The gods control the rains. The gods control the farm. The gods control all of this. And I'm telling you, none of that is true. I am God and I am good. So you need to go into this land and not borrow practices from all these other pagan religions and pagan cultures, because if you do, it will separate you from me, and I am the source of your life. And this code will teach you how to set up a society that does not practice those things, which will ultimately separate you from me. So these laws, although they sound harsh to us, if you're going into a world with no law, where a slave can be treated any way you want to, all of a sudden a law that says, no, if you have a Hebrew slave, he'll only be yours for 6 years, and in the seventh year you set him free. To the rest of the world, they're going, what are you talking about? 150-something years ago, we went through a theological crisis in the United States. The Civil War is a theological crisis. Why? Because if I was born in the South, I would be preaching to you that black people were somehow less valuable than white people and should be viewed as slaves and property. And the biggest argument in the Civil War was, what do we do if we get rid of millions of slaves? The entire Southern economy will collapse. Then what? So it's not as simple as, oh, that's a weird Old Testament law. God is giving them laws that will protect them from the practices that they've learned in Egypt that they would be subject to in Canaan. So we always need to see these laws against the backdrop of what they're moving into. Still weird. Still weird. When I went back to New Guinea in December 2 years ago, when my son-in-law passed away, there's a lot of things that happen in this culture that, again, are relevant to this text. My son-in-law owned several dozen acres in the middle of 1,500 acres of his father's coffee plantation. And it was his, and it was building a house on it. But in New Guinea culture, when the son dies, all the rest of the brothers show up the next morning and start divvying up the property. That's just the way it goes. It's to protect the family interest from being taken over by a foreign tribe. Unfortunately, the wife is left with nothing other than she will be taken care of and fed. And so the missionary said to me, Glenn, you need to be strong. I said, what does that mean? They said, you need to speak to your son-in-law's dad and to his brothers, and you tell them that you expect them to take care of your daughter for the 6 months she's going to remain here until she moves back to the States. And you need to tell them that they need to protect your wife because she's staying for 90 days to take care of Melissa, so you need to speak strong. So I had to call a meeting, have a meeting with my son-in-law's dad and his older brothers and younger brothers, and there's about 7 or 8 of them. And the missionaries coached me, and I was trembling inside. I said, listen here, I love all of you, but you do not want me to be coming back here, getting off a plane, coming back here to find out that you did something to my daughter or my wife, or that you took this land, which my grandson Alex will claim when he's 18. You look me in the eye and you tell me you're going to protect that, or you're going to have one angry pastor getting off the plane with the armies of heaven coming with me. And they said, oh no. Oh no, Pastor Glenn, don't worry. Her interests will be protected. And they are. And it goes back to this kind of a culture. So it's really amazing when you go to other countries and you see some of these things come alive and you say, oh, this is not as strange. I just want you to see when God gives them these laws and the laws seem weird to us against the backdrop of no law or against the backdrop of human life being devalued completely, these laws are grace. This is the implementation of legislative grace. Never think that there's not grace. God has been about grace from the beginning. It's a grace to tell a family, you take care of that bride that's being married to your son because you're changing the economic status of the whole village. So be careful. So that's the backdrop. It's an amazing thing. The ordinances here, there are dozens of them that flesh out how the Ten Commandments will be lived out. There are 10 commandments in the Old Testament. There are about 613 ordinances or rules or laws in Exodus, in the Pentateuch, and the rest of the Old Testament. Because it takes that many. Well, we haven't gotten past that. Here's John Rawls, A Theory of Justice. This would be more of a liberal, classic, democratic case for how rights are to be distributed in society. Here's Robert Nozick's Anarchy, State, and Utopia. this is all about libertarianism. These are two completely different versions of how human beings should live together in a society. So we still debate the finer points of, if you live there and I live here and you live there and I live there and I own this and you own that, how do we do that? So we live in a world where this is still an ongoing thing. My argument to Christians is get into the law, get into the courts, get into politics, protect your soul. But we need Christians to go in and be salt and light to help bring an infusion of love, an infusion of mercy, an infusion of grace. Because we still live with laws. I went down to Springfield. A couple years ago, my friend Mark Buzel, who's a member here, was the chief of staff of Governor Jim Edgar for 8 years, works in Washington, works in Springfield. He said, Glenn, do you really want to see how it works? And I went down there. And yes, we can all say, how many of you, if I said Springfield is broken, how many of you would you raise your hand? Except that when I was down there, I saw a lot of things that weren't broken. Of all the things you see on the news, they pass about 6,700 bills that have to do with the size of the parking lot and whether or not red lights have to be 10 feet, 12 feet, 14, all these strange rules that you go, why do you need that? Well, you need that if the tree is this big, and if that person owns the tree on that corner next to the light, somebody's got to decide. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that we don't even know that make our lives doable, livable, because somebody has thought, you better have a parking lot that big, and you better have bathrooms this big. And we still live in that arcane sort of strange world of all these legislative details. Another thing to remember about the backdrop of this is there's no such thing as big business. How many of you can think of at least one big business? How many of you can think of 100? Like, you see the brands all the time, Whole Foods and Best Buy and different car brands. Global enterprise. There, the Fortune 500 is bigger than the GDP of all but the top 10 largest countries in the world. Corporations are big. They employ hundreds of thousands of people, and they span the globe. None of that exists. My point here is, in ancient Israel, every business is a small business. And every small business is attached to a home, a house. So what you see in here is business law that's protecting you and your neighbor from encroaching on each other's rights to run your farm, run your ranch, run your silversmith. But whatever it is you're running, every family has a business. That's how you stay alive. Farming, merchant, whatever it is, every business is small. So you got to have lots of little laws. That's what a lot of these laws are all about. But never forget that the big principle is that God is calling Israel to be a covenant people, to live in relationship. And God is saying, okay, here's how you live in relationship with me, but that person down the street that you don't like, I created them too. And I know you don't like them, or you don't like the way they cut their lawn, or you don't like the paint that they used on their house, but they are my creation too, and we've got to figure out a way for you to coexist. And that's not going to be easy. Another little detail about this text, and especially the language of slavery, the word slave, the Hebrew word for slave, is used over 1,000 times in the Old Testament, because that is the economic backdrop of the ancient world. There is no country in the ancient world that is not thoroughly permeated with slavery. You don't look back in the ancient world and go, oh yeah, look, there's Persia or there's Babylon. They don't have any slaves. If you would have talked to a person from 3,500 years ago and said there will be a come a time when in the future there will be whole countries that have no slaves, they'd say, what? How do you do that? That's weird. There's no culture in the ancient world in which slaves are not an important part of the economy. So God is moving them in, gradually shaping and shaping and shaping and moving to the point where it's Christian theology that leads to a final argument against slavery. You know what the final argument against slavery was? That the church, the early church, would serve communion. And the household head, the husband, would get served first because, well, because he's the man and he's important. And then the other important men, and then the wife, and then the manager, and then the workers, and then the children, and then the last row, the slaves who'd been captured in wars from other countries. And the pastor would say, "The body of Christ broken for you, the blood of Christ shed for you." And somebody figured out, wait a second, if the body of Christ is broken for the head of the household and the body of Christ is broken for the slave, maybe what Paul said in Galatians, that we were all the same at the foot of the cross, maybe that should change the status of how we view the people in our lives. Maybe we shouldn't own slaves. That was the progression. But back in these days, the laws of slavery are to protect against the absolute abuse of people. And there were different categories. There were workers, there were employees, there were servants, and there were slaves. And sometimes the same word is used to describe all four. And so you really have to dig into the linguistics. What is being talked about here in Exodus is primarily two of them. One of them are indentured servants. So if I borrow something from you, or I kill your cow accidentally, and your cow is worth $1,000. I don't have $1,000 to pay you. Okay, I've got time. I am now yours for as long as it takes to pay back that $1,000. That's an indentured servant. Then there are slaves who are caught because they're caught from a foreign war. They represent a foreign country that's been beaten in battle, and you are taken in as a slave. Even those people in Hebrew law are to be treated with equity. So at some point in time, that slave that originally was your enemy may actually get to the point where the slave says, "Hey, life is pretty good with this master. I don't want to leave. I think I'll stay." Now you see the redemptive purposes. This is very different than grab a slave, grind them into the ground for your own labor, and don't care about them. No, even slaves that are enemies are created in God's image. And so the law here is actually introducing grace into a very ungraceful world. So you could have foreign-born and caught in war. You could have people who are in a 6-year contract. Then what happens? What happens if I'm your slave and I've been there for 6 years, and during that time I got married? And during that time I also had children. Well, because I'm owned by you, the children are now in question. Where do they go? And so here you've got laws that protect that. If the slave wants to stay, then this. If the slave doesn't want to stay, then this. Because you got economic status to be dealt with. So it's really kind of a strange thing, and it's a powerful thing. The other thing here is, even though it looks like women are being treated as second-class citizens, and in some sense they are for sure, against the backdrop of ancient culture, where women are just property, this is beginning to lift women up. Not as far as many of you would like to see. I get that. I wasn't there. I didn't write the code. I'm telling you, though, you have to see it against the backdrop of an ancient world. So there are laws here that govern servants. There are laws here that govern employee relations. Laws on how you treat a woman in and through marriage and sexual impropriety and those kinds of things. What happens if you injure other people? What happens if you injure their animals? What happens if the injury was accidental versus the injury being intentional? They began to make a distinction between accidental and intentional. We do the same thing. Was it involuntary manslaughter or was it murder? Should the law recognize a difference? I think most of us would say, yeah. If I premeditatively say, "I don't like you and I'm going to kill you," that's entirely different than me accidentally running into you with my car. Both, however, have now caused harm. So justice is the restoration of that which was taken. A lot of people ask me, "Pastor Glenn, what about God as the judge? That's harsh." That's because you have a half picture of what justice means. When you start reading through Exodus and you read all the way through the Old Testament into Jesus in the New Testament, you realize Justice, in a biblical sense, is always restorative. Somebody has something taken from them. You don't just forgive the perpetrator. You got to figure out how the person who had something taken from them gets restored. Justice in the Old Testament always is about restoring balance. Remember, over the last couple weeks, I said the design of God at creation is that we are created for human flourishing. Well, how do I flourish if you kill my cow? And then some judge says, well, you're forgiven. Okay, but I'm still minus a cow. And my children still need milk and meat. So what do I do with that? One of the powerful principles that you see in Exodus, if you read through this, is every one of these cases has as its balancing principle the intention that the harmed party will have restored to them that which was taken by the person who did the harm. That's huge. That's a big deal. We have removed that to some degree in our modern law. In this case, if I harm you, you have the right to look me in the eye, not my lawyer, me, and say, you took my cow. I need a cow. Where's my cow? Excuse me. Remember a couple of weeks ago, we read about Jethro and Moses and the division of labor? Now you see what those judges are going to do. Somebody comes to you and says, this lady here took my cow. I need a cow. And the judge says, did you take his cow? And you hash it out. And then you find a way for the person who took the cow to be the one who pays. If you can't pay for the cow, well, then you got to come work for me. Boy, I'd love to have her work for me. She does anyway. It's free. She does it because she loves me and loves this church. But you see how that works? That's the principle that embeds this entire conversation. How does the harmed party get restored? It's really quite powerful. So you have laws about servants and women and injury and willful injury and accidental injury. You have laws governing capital punishment. Now, we think that we're enlightened, and we are to some degree. But here in Illinois, capital punishment perpetrated by our governors? Which of the governors in Illinois for the last 30 years would you trust to issue a decree of capital punishment? You see what I'm saying? So, yes, we've made progress, but maybe not so much. Illinois, we just did a study, I read about this from University of Illinois. Illinois and Chicago politics are some of the most corrupt in the United States. How many of you are surprised by that? Which is why when Jethro says to Moses, find men who cannot be corrupt, find men who cannot be bought, because even the best law implemented by a terrible law enforcer or lawgiver can be problematic. So you got laws governing capital punishment. You've got laws governing injury to animals, property, burglary, neglect. What if I neglect my property and I live next to you? How many of you have ever lived in a neighborhood where one house can bring the neighborhood value down? How does that make you feel when you go to sell your house? That's why there are laws. You got to maintain your lawn and maintain, because there's something that we all have to lose. If there's somebody who's not caring for their property and then it costs you, now society's off balance. And so you have all of that in these two or three chapters of Exodus. Those are the principles. A couple other things that you should know. How many of you think we have a good jail system in the United States? But we have one. How many jails do you think they had in ancient Israel? Zero. Zero. Let that sit with you for a minute. There are no places of incarceration in ancient Israel. We are going to solve this now with a judge, with the parties who have issue with each other, and it's not going to carry on, and we're not going to take debt for you, and we're not going to feed you, we're not going to put you in this system that probably will make you worse. We don't have jails. We have justice, we have laws, we have ways of implementing justice. I can't begin to describe how radically different that is. Radically different. Radically different. No jails. Because they believed in restitution, not residency. In other words, you restore that which was taken. We're not going to house you for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. We believe you've got to restore that which was taken. So there's a couple of, or maybe four benefits to that, that ethicists have seen looking back at ancient Israel's laws. The victim had to be compensated by the perpetrator. I mean, at least on its face, that sounds fair, doesn't it? If I do something, shouldn't I be the one? Yes, modern insurance and a whole bunch of other things, we've figured out how to balance that out. Because what if I do something to you and it's catastrophic and I can't repay you? Well, we have as a society come up with ways of doing that called insurance, etc. But the compensation is coming at least originally from the person who did the harm. The offender has to deal directly with the offended. I was in a lawsuit about 12 years ago, and the person who was suing me never showed up. Never showed up. I never got to look him in the eye in court and say, "You're lying." My attorney did, but there's something, and that process took 4 years and cost $30,000 in legal fees. There's something about, no, it's on the docket for next week. That's why Jethro told Moses to get more guys so we could make justice quicker. That principle is here in Exodus. A third benefit is that this way of restitution gives no cost to the wider society. It doesn't cost you. If I hurt somebody, I have to pay him back, not you. Now, there's a couple dangers to this as well. In this system, it can be abused by somebody who's rich. Because if all I have to do is pay for what I've stolen from you, if I steal your cow and I have enough money to pay for 1,000 cows, I could do this every day. So it defaulted to the uber wealthy, and that began to be a problem, which is why you see later principles of distribution of wealth and a principle of jubilee every 7 years and every 49 years and debt. There was a way of equaling these things out so that somebody with lots of money couldn't game the system. Thank goodness we've figured that out and nobody with lots of money games the system now. I'm not going to say any more because I'm going to get in trouble. On all sides of the political spectrum, money buys you stuff. It just does. And that shouldn't be the case. When you hear arguments in our news about various things happening, they'll always defer to, and I agree with this, no one should be above the law. Guess where that comes from? Thank you, Moses. Thank you, ancient Israel. What do I do if I'm an indentured servant and I don't even have 2 nickels to my name, but I'm working hard and somebody with lots of money wants to abuse me? I have the law that stands between me and that person. Unless you can buy your way through the system. And in ancient Israel, at least in the beginning, you could not do that. So that was one of the dangers. Another danger of not having a prison system is that what if you got somebody who's really a danger to society? Then what do? You need to protect society from that person. So I'm not saying that there's a perfection here. I'm just simply saying that the principles here kind of get lost in our modern jurisprudence system. So let's talk about this for a second. Modern slavery. This text talks about slavery. And all of us would say, I'm not buying slaves. I don't understand that. That's not part of my modern world. Do you know that there are more slaves on planet Earth right now than at any time in human history? And guess what gender most of them are? Somewhere between 29 and 32 million. You want to read about that stuff? Read from Gary Haugen, who started International Justice Mission. Good news about injustice and ways that we can help. Guess where a lot of those women are? In the sex trade, and get sold. Guess what contributes to that? The pornography industry in the United States contributes directly to that. Money and exposure and connection, a whole bunch of things. So we can look at Exodus and go, man, that's a really weird culture, and it is. As long as we're willing to look at our culture and say, man, that's a really weird culture too, because by now we should have learned something. That's the power of this text, that there's some moral precedents that we still haven't figured out. To me, that's powerful. To me, that's very powerful. So when you look through this, you see a bunch of different things. You see laws governing relationships. Pastor Mark and I were talking, and he's got a good threefold way of looking at these laws that I think might be helpful to you. Many of them are civil law. What do I do about my neighbor's house? And how should I, what if I want to build my roof higher than your roof? That's civil law that adjudicates between people in a society who are competing over different things or different understanding, and it's civil law. And we all need that. We have thousands of those laws that we all obey, and we don't even know we're obeying them because we've just grown up in a culture. I remember when I was a little kid and I wanted to run across the street against the red light. My mother said, "You can't, you'll be jaywalking." I thought, what's jaywalking, you know? And now, I mean, I don't cross. If it's a red light, I'm like, it doesn't matter. It could be 3 a.m, there's no cars. Yes, ma'am. So we obey because I had a friend who was a wealthy kind of business owner, acquaintance, let's call him more of an acquaintance, and I got in his car one day, and it was a Lexus, and it was decked out, and he was decked out, and he's like wanting to get to the airport, and he's flying 105 miles an hour, and he's blowing through stop sign. I'm like, Russ, stop. He's like, those laws, those are just to keep slow people slow. So all of us are cultured into obeying civil law. Another way that Pastor Mark looks at this, so some of them are civil law, some of them are what's called cultic, or spiritual, or religious law. When you get together, sacrifice a bull like this, put it on the altar here, slice its throat this way. There are laws about religion. We have some rules around here. We're going to start the service at 9:30. It's going to end at 10:30 unless Pastor Glenn is preaching. That was my attempt at humor. Only half of you got it. Some of you haven't been in one of my sessions. Although, there are a few other people who can go longer than me, so here we go. But we have understanding of the right way to do communion is. The right way to take offering is. The right way, there's just rules that govern our interactions as a people with the institution of the church and the God that we worship. So ancient Israel had those as well. There's a third set of laws, though. They are moral laws. How you should treat your neighbor with an intent. Like, if I accidentally hurt you, that's one thing. But if I intend to hurt you, because the principle there is now I'm putting myself in the position of the Creator. If I accidentally hurt you, that just shows that I'm human. But if I willfully connive and plan to hurt you, I'm putting myself in the position of the Creator. I'm saying, I have power over you. And the Creator says, no, you don't. That person that you're going to hurt, they are equal in my eyes. So you have these three types of law: civil, cultic, or religious and moral law. To me, some of those distinctions are pretty powerful, but what I'd like to do now is for the last 10 minutes that we have, talk about how does this affect us? How does this impact us as Christians? I don't want to go back and live in this world, do you? Not at all. I don't always want to live in this world either. Sometimes this world is kind of crazy too. because we live in a world where there are modern slaves. You want to read about that? This is a book I recommended a few years ago called Half the Sky by Nicholas Kristof. It comes from a Middle Eastern parable that says women hold up half the sky. So even if you don't believe in fairness for women and you're a guy, you're stupid if you cut them off at the knees, because if they fall, half the sky falls and it falls on you too. So don't be dumb. And this is all about stories of women around the world who wish they could live in ancient Israel. I don't recommend you read this until after Christmas. It's hard stuff. Here's a book that came out a few years ago by, he's a philosopher, sociologist, Francis Fukuyama, called Trust, that implied behind all of our laws, between one business and another, between a husband and a wife, between a citizen and its city, between a nation and another nation, is the ability to trust. If I can't trust that you're going to obey the traffic laws, when I see a green light, am I going to go through? If I believe everyone sitting at the red light is in danger of saying, who cares, like my acquaintance friend who didn't care, I have to trust that you're going to obey the same laws that I will. And then society works. And when you erode those things, society begins to lower its trust. And trust has a definite economic equation. All of us are hurting because trust goes down. So these concepts here in Exodus, they might be ancient, but this is from the Creator, God of the universe. The one who designed the laws of physics has also designed the laws of moral order. Even in New Guinea, where you would say, my gosh, were there any laws? Even in ancient tribal societies where there are no judges, no laws, no written laws, there still are laws that are embedded in the ancient culture about what's right and what's not, what's fair and what's not. Because some ancient philosophers said we have a moral ought. There's something in us. We may debate what actually it looks like to be right in a given situation, but none of us debate that there probably is a right way. We just sort of lean into that as human beings. In fact, if you find a person who does not have that sense of moral ought, they probably are a sociopath. Because a sociopath says, I see no wrong. I see no wrong in the violent things I've done. Therefore, there's no regret, there's no shame, there's no guilt. There's a disconnect. But all of us in this room, we believe there's a right way. We may quibble about what that looks like, but not that there is one. So that's what's behind all this. The Creator saying, I love you. You don't know what you don't know. You don't know how to live together. You just came out of 400 years of slavery. Don't be like them. If I don't give you these laws, you're going to turn into the Egyptians and you're going to make it worse for the people that live and work with you. So I want you to be different. Why? Because I want the world to look in and see this is what a society can look like when it worships the one true God and it lives in a world where it believes that every one of its neighbors has been created in his image and deserves all the rights that pertain to that created image. So let's talk about what Jesus had to say. Matthew chapter 5, verse 48. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now that can turn into a real guilt trip, so I'm not trying to do that. Jesus' point here is, be like your Father, whose moral perfection makes him beautiful and lovely. When you meet somebody who's really good, and I'm not saying they're perfect, every one of us sins, we know that, but there are some people that I just meet and I think, man, that's a good guy. That guy's really a good guy, and it makes me look like I got to step up my game. All of us are created in the image of a God who wants thriving of his creation. So what if I try to live like that? What if I try to see my neighbor or my enemy, the other person, through the lens of the way God sees them? That's what Jesus is saying. Be like God. Be like your father. Okay, Matthew 5, 17 to 20. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. That's an interesting statement. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not even the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. That's hard stuff. And Jesus is essentially saying to a group of people, wait a minute, you want everyone else to live up to the law, but you don't want to. I'm telling you that if you live like me, you will fulfill the law because you're going to be a loving person, and love always seeks the best, always seeks the right. But until then, you need to understand, you think the Pharisees are problematic? Your righteousness better exceed them, because all you're doing is judging them. Jesus is using moral law that goes all the way back to Exodus and saying, okay, you want off the hook, but you don't want to let everybody else off the hook. How does that work? Let's keep going. Two more passages that I want to read for you. This is the Apostle Paul writing to a church at Galatia, chapter 3, verse 23 to 24. This is one of my favorite passages in the New Testament. Before the coming of this faith that we all have, faith in Jesus Christ and his redemption and his salvation, we were held in custody under the law, locked up until the faith that was to come would be revealed. So the law was our guardian until Christ came, that we might be justified by faith. The word guardian there can be translated babysitter. The law is your babysitter. Until you are fully perfected in love, until you follow Jesus, you need someone to say, no, don't do that, that's wrong. I got four little case studies in that at home. My little grandsons, definitely there are days they lean into the good, and they want to do good, and then the wheels come off, oh man, and they need someone to say, Thurston, no, you can't hit your brother in the head with that truck. Really, you need to be told that? Yeah, you do. You need a babysitter. You need the law to tell you what your worst impulses will always hide. You need the law to say, no, you can't do that. Can't do that. But at best, that's a babysitter. It's like the guardrails. How many of you have ever driven down the Pacific Coast Highway in California? Where it's like weaving, it's gorgeous, but on one side is the Pacific Ocean and 200